Thanks for joining us. My name is Ibrahim Sani. We're doing this particular session in the hallway of the Grand Ballroom of Mandarin Oriental because we are attending the International Social Wellbeing Conference 2023 organized by the Employees Provident Fund, or EPF, along with some of their partners. Astrawan is the official broadcaster of this event. Yesterday, we saw the conference see a whole host of conversations, particularly when we saw the kickoff announcement coming in from the CEO of EPF, where he outlined some of the key figures when it comes to social protection and how to improve social well-being. We've heard a lot of policy decision makers trying to decipher what needs to be done in the next, say, for instance, 2 to 3 decades, prolonging the issue of Malaysia's lifespan, for instance, and how do we deal with that, and other groups of people that require further protection, including that of children, and how we can ensure that those that are in the working class can support the generations above them and the children generation below them. So this and more was discussed yesterday. Today we just saw the Prime Minister making his prime ministerial speech, and of course some of the key highlights there include the importance for us to talk on this topic on social well-being at the policy level. So there's a lot that needs to be discussed there. But for this particular conversation, I have with me on set is Dr. Hilmi Hajamaidin, is the Chief Executive Officer of the Socioeconomic Research Institute. Initiatives, pardon me. Dr. Hilmi, you're also the advisor to the health minister. In fact, let's start with that. The health white paper that was initially approved by the Dewan Rakyat saw some of the plans and the policy that needs to be undertaken over the next, say, 10 to 15 years. Maybe we can talk more to that effect before we jump into the whole social well-being conference.
I would say the two are intertwined. They're very much connected because at the end of the day, approximately 80% of what we see in healthcare are due to issues of socioeconomic well-being as well as behavioural factors. So by the time I see a patient with, say, lung cancer in my clinic, that person has gone through various issues when it comes to how they smoke, whether they choose to smoke or not, where they get access to health, whether they actually have enough awareness or education about the issues at play. Globally, if you look at it, there are increasing challenges when it comes to healthcare. The most obvious is that of cost. So in terms of wanting to ensure that everyone, irrespective of one's background, no matter how vulnerable you may be or disenfranchised you may be, ensuring that everyone actually gets the best possible care, that is the ideal that we want. That's the, I suppose, the ethos that all healthcare professionals want to practice. But in order to get there, it has to be sustained by a very realistic framework, particularly financially. And knowing that, acknowledging that, is one key reason why a health white paper was presented to Dewan Rakyat and to Dewan Negara recently. The white paper is a conceptual paper, so it's really setting the framework, the agenda of what should happen over the next 15 years. And the idea is to create this framework that will eventually be looked over or be monitored by a committee that's answerable to Parliament, so that it is something that occurs and is executed beyond multi-party politics, because
the issue I have with long-term, long-horizon kind of policy paper is that demographies change, the rate of NCDs, for instance, change, life expectancy changes, socioeconomic situation also changes. How do you ensure that the contents within the white paper is still relevant in the years to come, considering all these changes, all these variables are in play?
So those are very, very good points, because the four pillars within the white paper include one of governance. So governance, I would argue, is something that is going to be, you know, relevant irrespective
immutable,
of the timeline.
If you get it right.
Something you need to do in terms of processes, in terms of transparency, in terms of accountability. You've got the issue of financing. So as time goes by, we'll be looking into the various models that we can potentially adopt in order to make this something sustainable. And then we are looking into preventive and promotive healthcare as well. So that's a very key point, because irrespective of what the numbers, the specific numbers may be, we know for a fact, once again, that the vast majority of healthcare issues are things that can be prevented in the first place or can be dealt with at the primary care level. So moving forward, we want to have less hospitalizations, less issues where people are seeking tertiary care, more healthcare that's available in the community and healthcare that's available not just in GPs or primary care facilities, but potentially even homes and care homes. So that goes into your point about aging or different demographics, because as time goes by, we know that Malaysia is an aging nation. So that also means that we have to be prepared for these things, not just from a medical perspective, but in terms of rehab, in terms of the facilities, even in terms of how we approach these individuals. And the fourth, but also equally important pillar is service provision. So service provision in the sense that, once again, we want to make sure that nobody is left behind. We are not being biased in terms of who gets preferential treatment, and also in terms of ensuring that access is not impaired by one's socioeconomic background, and we are improving things in terms of efficiency and efficacy. So this would include, you know, the hot topics these days are digitalization, right? We want everything to be on the computer, we want everything to be telemedicine, we want to be able to bridge geographical gaps. So these are all encapsulated within the health white paper. And your key question, I suppose, is how is this going to not become obsolete, right? It's something we cannot be too prescriptive about it. And by nature, on purpose, by design, it is not prescriptive at all. It is once again ensuring that these frameworks are in place so that people cannot shy away from the difficult discussions that need to take place. But as time goes by, in the next 5 to 15 years, there will be working groups. There will be people who will be looking into particular issues. For example, if we talk about financing, then there will be a working group that will be consisting of stakeholders from insurance, from hospitals, from people's welfare groups, all coming into play to then nail down those details that may not necessarily be set in stone, but should be a living document that will enable us to address the issues as and when they occur.
Now, of course, when we look at some of the models that are in place, say, for instance, the NHS in England, it was considered or touted as one of the more important models to emulate across the country, across the globe. Today, we've seen how the NHS is crippled. Much of the idea of or the problem that is besetting them, we too are facing it. NHS workers are underpaid, overworked. The waiting time has increased dramatically, especially under Rishi Sunak's administration, where patients, 7 million patients are now waiting more than a year for treatment, especially non-elective treatment or elective treatment. The same can be said about Malaysia as well. People are on the waiting list in terms of receiving donor transplant. These issues, these are the health system's issues. And of course, we have NCDs that are quite staggering numbers. I still can't believe it when you talk about 1 in 5 Malaysians have diabetes diagnosed. We all know how Malaysians hate to diagnose themselves, so that number could potentially be very high, or at least higher than 1 in 5. Right now it's at 19%, if I'm not wrong. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, the whole habitual behavior of smoking. You're a proponent of that. I'm still a recovering addict of smoking. There's so many things that needs to be talked about when it comes to national health systems. So what comes from this white paper other than these working groups? Will there be legislative in play, more legislations, particularly tobacco control, or, I guess, activities where we can get people to walk around, get the 10,000 steps or something like that to actually manage their lifestyle and reduce NCDs? What next from this white paper?
I think the first key thing is to ensure that a commission that we are proposing to create comes into being. Because once again, we want a commission that consists of individuals who are representing appropriate stakeholders. And that would include people, once again, those who are more vulnerable, those who are disenfranchised, also those from the medical field, those from an economist, for example. The idea, once again, is someone who is neutral, someone who's agnostic of whatever political affiliation, so that this does not die. If you look at it, once again, it's not just a Malaysian thing, if you look at things globally, there's always a tendency to use healthcare as a political football.
It always is. Healthcare and education.
Healthcare, education, exactly. And these are things that, you know, to me, has to be above politics, because the issues do not change. It's just the manner in which you address them and whether you choose to highlight the problems or deal with the problems and try to come with a solution. So in terms of having that four pillars, that's the idea of having those frameworks. Now, we cannot be too prescriptive. So, for example, if we want to use the example of how we eat, because diabetes, primarily, once again, if we have enough things in place to ensure that we eat healthily, where we are actually educating people in terms of what's an appropriate diet, cutting down rates of being overweight and being obese, these are factors that are actually far more effective And cheaper. Also far cheaper, exactly. Because
cheaper.
The cost of eating properly versus the cost of getting your foot chopped off because of gangrene from diabetes is very, very different. And it's not just the cost to the hospital or to the government, it's the cost and the impact on the individual and the family that's behind the individual. And that's why I think it's very important that when we talk about healthcare, the reason why I'm here at this conference is because it's very much interlinked with what sort of safety nets that are available within the government, within society, as well as what kind of priorities that we place in terms of pushing agendas forward. If we talk about healthy eating for kids, right? Mm-hmm. If we have schools that provide education and mm-hmm. provide a healthy meal at least once a day, mm-hmm. that will go a long way towards ensuring that malnutrition is addressed to some degree. And you talked about diabetes, but what for me was even more shocking was, yes, we have got a group of people who overeat or eat unhealthily, but we also have about 1 in 5 children who are stunted in their growth because they're not actually getting enough nutrition.
Especially the urban poor.
Especially the urban poor. So you go to our PPR flats, you may, you know, what we take for granted in terms of having your 5 a day, for example, is completely alien to a lot of these individuals, and it may not necessarily always be a case of education, but also of cost.
If I were to accuse you of something, I would accuse you of being optimistic, an idealistic optimistic. Essentially, the reality is that healthcare will be politicized. Healthcare is going to affect all of us, so even those that are not necessarily clued in into the healthcare system and health systems and health reforms will have a say in terms of how it's being done. In fact, if you just Google the health minister's name and go to the news section of Google, you're going to see her news every day, mostly in a negative light. How do you ensure that these long-term goals are attainable and achieved, but having to deal with the noise of today? How do you manage that balance?
It is a difficult balance, and I don't envy Dr. Zaliha in her role because she's juggling in terms of having to deal with the system that we have inherited, the issues that we've inherited, alongside current and future problems, because it's an ongoing challenge. It's not something that's static. And besides troubleshooting and dealing with day-to-day issues, from issues of clinic dive where you've got clinics that are more than 50 years old with leaking rooftops, all the way to issues of ensuring that there is an appropriate distribution of resources and skills, those are all very challenging issues. And I think undoubtedly there will be attacks, there will be criticisms. But what we in the team are very much focused on is I wouldn't say we are completely ignoring the noise, but I think we are wanting appropriate feedback. So there's this constant level of engagement with the stakeholders, whether it's with junior doctors all the way to scientists who are wanting to.
Why not?
I know, right?
Yeah.
Just shows how much pressure I'm on.
Yeah.
to the scientists that are wanting to do more work with KKM. These are things that we are continuously engaging with. And I think internally, the key thing is also about choosing the right people and the right processes within the ministry that can make a biggest impact. To give you an example, one of the key things that we identified early on was the fact that there is such a huge waiting list and congestion in emergency departments.
That's right.
And from that, she did a few spot checks. She went to a few different places. She spoke to the people on the ground. And you soon come to realize that isn't a panacea for all of this, right? Each hospital, each busy ED is usually busy for a different reason. For some, it's because they've got nowhere else to go. For some, it's because there's insufficient staff. For some, it's because patients actually go there inappropriately. And it's all about really engaging with the people on the ground, engaging with the people who are providing the service. And that includes the people who are using the service, and then figuring out how to manage and change things. With Klang Hospital, what we did was we got into a partnership, into a program where we not only worked with the local ED, but we worked with local private GPs, and we got the MPC, the Malaysian Productivity Corporation. So they came in to look at the process flow, how to cut off excess meat to make the process and service provision leaner. And these were things that we're looking at. And what we have seen in Klang is that the numbers of people waiting have come down, the people who are primarily were in the green zone. So these are people who are not particularly serious in terms of their presentations. You were able to offload them to clinics nearby. And this goes to show that when you look into the processes and when you are doing the kind of like deep dive into the details, you can make very, very important changes. But it may not be a sexy thing to shout about, right? You go out and say, hey guys, I'm going to look at the processes in Klang. People may not be too keen on that.
In fact, you're going to be accused of micromanaging issues because you know the minister should be, you know, high-level politics. But you're going to be accused anyway. But because if the minister doesn't look at the day-to-day, then the minister is going to be accused.
It's a balance because in that sense, once again, we go to that particular case, it's about identifying the issue. Yes, throwing your political and ministerial weight behind an issue and then empowering the right individuals to run things. So we didn't have to go down to the ground and start a new process. We had very good people, very hardworking individuals who know what's going on far better than we do, but knowing that they have our support, knowing that they can come to us with issues or whether it's resources or whether there are issues in terms of obstructions, then at least it gives them that confidence. So I think a lot of it goes down to empowering the people on the ground as well. And once again, not easy. Lots of issues that are beyond our control, but we do where we can. And yes, I may be a hopeless optimist.
An idealistic optimist.
But at the end of the day, I don't expect any of us to change everything all at once. Right, we want to do things incrementally. We want to be very cognizant of where our spheres of influences are and work on those issues so that where we can make a difference, we will make a difference so that ultimately it's the patient who gets a better outcome.
Okay, now drawing back to this conference on the International Social Wellbeing Conference organized by EPF, yesterday the CEO of EPF made a particularly interesting argument here that the conference is exceedingly timely because social protection coverage in Malaysia, and I quote him, is 9.1% of intended beneficiaries being covered versus a 55.1% for Asia or 13% for the world. So essentially, most of Asia has a coverage, a good coverage, and you know around the world there's poor coverage, but Malaysia is really bad at 9.1%. What kind of social protection benefits do you think needs to be discussed at this conference or conferences like these in order for us to get that conversation starting? Is it more public-private partnership? Is it more private players coming to the picture? Is it better governance? Is it more GDP per capita? Sorry, the GDP allocation towards the health ministry? What needs to be said and done in these type of conferences?
If I were to look at it from a more health ministry point of view, of course, we would like more funding to come our way. I think that is something that all health ministries across the globe is wanting.
Definitely.
And in Malaysia, we want to see an increase in the percentage of GDP that's allocated to the health ministry. But it is also, I think, very, very important for us to be able to justify what that funding is for. And that would include looking into ways in which we could make things leaner, make sure that there's less issues of leakages within the system, because I think that's another thing that we have to look in very holistically, perhaps not just in the health ministry, but with all ministries across the board. And when you do have that funding coming in, then we need to go into a system where I think we have a very good feedback mechanism. So setting policies is one thing, but ultimately, to me, once again, if we are looking at social protection, we have to go from the perspective of the individual that we're wanting to help. So what we may think in the office as important may not necessarily be the case for the person on the ground. And sometimes healthcare may be not about providing the right medication, it may be about providing the right type of transport from the person's house to the hospital or to the clinic.
Sorry, I didn't figure that out. It's always prescriptive, right?
It's like always prescriptive, medicine. Exactly. And you know,
but mobility is key.
Because that's the easiest thing to do. You know, as a doctor, I can just prescribe things, and then here, go take it, you'll feel better. But it is far more difficult. If I were to use, say, asthma, for example, right? Someone comes to me, asthma attack, asthma not well controlled, have a chat, take your inhaler, go away. Versus, okay, your asthma is not well controlled because you live in a house where it's dusty. Why is your house dusty? What is there that we can do to improve things? You're stressed. Why are you stressed? Because your work is not stable, because ultimately you may be fired next week. Those are the factors that are making that person have an asthma attack. Mm. But it's easy to ignore this and not care about it and just give that prescription. And I think what we should be doing more holistically moving forward is to block that silos between social protection, social welfare versus the outcome that we want from healthcare services. Because then you can see that there's a spectrum that we all can play a role in and ultimately, once again, get that patient a far better outcome.
the biggest issue that they need to untangle, at least EPF needs to untangle, is this basic savings achievement. Mm-hmm. We're looking at 240,000 ringgit by age 55. This translates to 1,000 ringgit per month for the next 20 years. So there's two issues here. First is long tail risk. Not many people now live until 75. That's a good thing. We are living longer. 79 for Malaysian life expectancy, more for ladies. And the second problem is, of course, only 3% have achieved that much of 240,000 by the age of 55. 4%, and apparently according to one of the speakers at EPF, that's the good thing, because last year was 3%, this year is 4%. We have retirement risk. And this retirement risk is now translating into a retirement crisis. So on a personal level, on an individual level, 96% of Malaysians don't have enough upon retirement. And then, of course, Malaysia is facing that situation where we want to give more to the health ministry, but because of restrictions and all the other ministries need to be provisioned as well, that's not going to happen anytime soon. So it seems like the task is very daunting that lies ahead of us.
It is, but at the same time, the mere fact that we are recognizing and discussing these issues is an important first step. Mm. It is easy to sweep things under the carpet and hope that someone else is going to deal with it. Mm. But the fact that we are openly discussing these issues, openly discussing options, I think is a very, very important first step. Mm. So financing, for example, right? There will come a time where we will need to make very difficult and very important decisions as to whether or not the manner in which our healthcare system is currently funded needs to be changed. Once again, if we go back to the health white paper, we purposely did not look into any specific models to avoid any unnecessary early sort of ugly political debates. Yeah. Because we want to ensure that, first of all, everyone understands the scale of the problem. Whatever numbers you said, those are the things that I think need to go out in the first instance to make people aware. Like, look, I've only got this much left. And we all know that most of your savings, most of your expenditure is going to occur when you're older. It may be because of personal issues, it could be because of health issues. So you could spend all your life saving and you may end up spending all of it in the last 5 years of your life. So these are the things that I think need to be out there, because ultimately, I think lots of policymakers are also driven by what they feel the stakeholders are making the most issues about or making the most noise about. So the education process, having media on board to highlight these issues, getting people to understand the scale of the issue will be very, very helpful in allowing us to then start that conversation leading to a potential solution.
Very quickly now, two areas I want to explore. First is, comparatively speaking, is Malaysia worse off or better off, generally speaking, compared to other ASEAN countries and Asian countries? And the second is, on my personal, I guess, inquisitive mind, do you think that the possibility of startups or businesses that come into this space has a potential to grow? So let's start with the first one, which is, are we worse off or better off compared to other countries?
It depends on what you're looking at. So once again, if let's say we are looking at the level of NCDs. So in ASEAN, we are number one when it comes to diabetes. We're number one when it comes to
obese,
overweight, right? But at the same time, nobody in Malaysia goes bankrupt because they have to spend for their healthcare cost. Right?
Well, you're benchmarking against US. The US is like, you can't fight that, man.
Exactly.
I mean, it's just bizarre.
So it's not
even
just
an EpiPen,
even an inhaler. You can, if you're not insured, you can go to an ED and get an inhaler. You have to buy an inhaler for like $1,000. Right?
You mean the Ventolin?
Yeah, one of the other brands. Yeah.
Okay.
Because I had a patient who had to go there, and then without insurance and all that. Exactly.
Okay.
What's your question? Oh yeah. So in terms of how we compare, so I think it depends on what you're looking at. You see, we have actually a very good level of support. As in, like, once again, no one's going to go bankrupt. No one's going to die due to lack of care. We have that in place. The issue is, can we sustain it in the manner that we want to? Can we increase or improve upon
it? It's breaking at the seams right now.
It's breaking at the seams. It's struggling at the seams.
Yeah.
And when we reach a point where we want to talk about biologics, we want to talk about, more personalized genomic-type medication, that is going to increase the cost pretty much exponentially.
Yeah.
So how do
But that's fine if you have a private sector for that and there are consumers for that particular sector. By all means, go ahead. There's also the public sector that we deal with.
But if you have a model in which the public and the private sector is able to work together, whether it's through a funding model or through a service provision, whether or not the ministry becomes less of a service provider and more of a regulator, then you can see how you can start to change things a little bit. But these are, once again, important discussions that commission should be leading so that when it comes to how we move forward, whether we are becoming more regulator, more service provider, or more service purchaser, these are the important discussions that we will need to have. So I don't think that it's easy to compare ourselves with other countries because it depends on what exactly you're looking at.
Yeah.
And once again, comparing us with, say, Singapore, which is an
island nation, complex right there,
versus Indonesia, which has got thousands of islands. Yeah. Right. So we want to make sure that, yes, we want to make things sustainable, but I think equity is also as important. That inequality between who gets what, that I feel is something that we should be very, very grateful for, and we should do our very best to protect.
Yeah, second half of my question, which is on the potential for startups or businesses that want to venture into medtech, health tech, biotech, because of the social well-being conversations that we're having now, do you think there's room to grow there?
Definitely. I think in Malaysia, there are lots of growth opportunities. If we look within the healthcare space, there, MITI has identified medical devices as one of the key growth areas.
MDA is busy, I'm sure.
And they are, exactly. And in fact, one of the good things that we have done with MDA, which we haven't quite... Wawarkan. Yeah. It's probably the first time I have to think about the English word, right?
I'm
reading my stuff.
Yeah.
Anyway, with MDA, for example, the moment we had a new CEO, he's done a fantastic job of once again making things more efficient. So turnaround time of licensing, actually getting things to be supplied into this market at a faster rate, all those things are KPIs that we are changing, achieving, and improving upon. And once again, it's about the processes. So the people who will realize and be appreciative are the people in the industry. And it goes to the point that if we make things easier, people will be happier. In this case, industrial stakeholders will be happier.
Yep.
And they'll see like, hey, this is improving, there's space to invest more.
Yep.
And this is where then we need to further break silos with other ministries, so with the MIDAS of the world, with MITI, make sure that we're working together to attract all these people that we need. But a lot of the investment that outsiders are looking into in Malaysia also boils down to what skills we have. So our skill sets, and this is applicable to the digital space, and it is applicable to R&D, it is applicable to healthcare. We have to ensure that from an education perspective, the graduates that we produce are fit for purpose. And this, I think, is another conversation that we can probably have.
We don't have time for that, unfortunately. But we will put a pin on it and we'll discuss a little bit more. That was Dr. Hilmi Hajamaidin, the CEO of the Socioeconomic Research Initiative. I got it right? Okay, sorry. He's also the advisor to the Health Minister of Malaysia. There's a lot of conversations that needs to be discussed when it comes to topics like this. Of course, stay on astrawarning.com, find out more there. My name is Ibrahim Sani. Catch you in the next one.